Our daily bread. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is on the phone from Israel. Her name is Dr. Natanella Elias. Dr. Elias, but I'm going to call her Natanella for the sake of the interview, was born and raised in Israel. And 3 years ago, she received a PhD from Tel Aviv University, which, by the way, Tel Aviv is one of the most beautiful cities I've ever visited there along the Eastern Mediterranean. In the field of cultural studies, with specific emphasis in the field of medieval English literature. And I've read her book, which we're going to talk about today. Her book is entitled The Gnostic Paradigm, Forms of Knowing in English Literature of the Late Middle Ages, was published in April of last year by Palgrave Macmillan in an extremely prestigious series entitled The New Middle Ages, edited by Bonnie Wheeler. Being myself a medievalist in a past life, I got very interested in having Natanella on the show, and I welcome you to Church and Culture. Thanks for coming on and being up so late at night in Israel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, Gnosticism is a subject that has fascinated me since I went to Princeton Theological Seminary back when I was a Southern Baptist. And then as a doctoral student at Emory, remained interested, and you and I both have in common reading one of the standard works on Gnosticism by Hans Jonas.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But you've taken Gnosticism and you distinguish between capital G Gnosticism, which was the so-called heresy of the early church, with
yes.
small G Gnosticism, which mm-hmm. you find still present as a residue in late medieval English literature in your book,
yes.
which
mm-hmm.
I thought was very fascinating topic for our listeners to hear about. Let's begin with, as I told you, let's begin and describe for our listeners basically what do we mean when we say big G Gnosticism?
Okay, well, Gnosticism was basically an ancient religion that stressed the special state of an illuminated few. And the basic corruption of the material world. Now, this is in very, very general terms because Gnosticism, with a capital G, is a broad term that couldn't really be pinpointed by scholars either. But they did manage to somehow define it as referring to a historical phenomenon, which was a religious, generally dualistic movement that existed approximately between the 1st and 4th centuries.
That was fought against by major Christian leaders like Irenaeus and
yes.
St. Augustine, correct?
Yes, it was considered one of the most influential and actually prevalent heresies for the early church fathers. Seemingly, by the 4th century, it was gone. But I discover that as late as the 14th century, there are Gnostic remnants in the literature of that time, which is very strange to say. Yeah.
Yeah, it is, and that's what got my attention. I'm talking to mm-hmm. Dr. Natanella Elias from Israel. She lives in fourth largest city, which is 12 kilometers outside of Tel Aviv. And give me the name of that city again.
Rishon LeZion.
And as I told Martinelle, I've been to Israel now five or six times. Love going there. Love Tel Aviv in particular. And but let's go over one more time the basic tenets of Gnosticism. We talked about the dualism, which consists of looking at the material world as basically evil. Correct?
Right. Right. Exactly. They see everything as basically divided into two. Which is actually similar in some ways to the Christian church as well, because there are the biggest forces in the world of good and evil. And if you look at a more specific and particular place, which is man himself, you have the division between body and soul.
For the Orthodox Christians, they don't look at the body as intrinsically evil and not from God.
Exactly, right? Because
now, what's this
God
about?
Everything God is good.
Now, what's this about an Illuminati, a special elite who receive, if they stay in a certain, as you describe it, passive state, a special revelation? Tell me about that.
Well, the Gnostics claimed that they're not speaking to everybody. They were not an inclusive kind of movement. They were very much exclusive. And they claimed that only certain few were the chosen ones who could actually gain salvation while here on earth. How would they go about doing that? That goes back to the name itself of the movement, Gnosticism. Gnosticism comes from the word gnosis, which means, in Greek, it means a kind of knowledge. It's a kind of insight. So it's not mathematical knowledge. It's not scientific knowledge. It's a kind of personal insight that one may gain through self-reflection.
Which involves experience, correct?
Yes, exactly.
And it's that experience in that you talk about the process of passing, which is the word you use to describe somebody who is a Gnostic who goes on this journey of seeking this enlightenment.
A soul journey.
Yeah. Now, my question is, I mean, a sort of a broad question is, if Gnosticism insisted that only a certain few could be chosen, how did Gnosticism become so widespread? How could it be so, you know, is it widespread in the sense that it was widespread among the elites? Or just how was it widespread?
It was probably appealing to the elite because there was this notion that only an elite few can actually be the chosen ones and transcend, right, and be saved. But it was widespread in the sense that the ideas were widespread, not necessarily the movement itself. So this is where I go into my own direction in the book, which basically says that we have to treat it slightly differently. So we're not talking about Gnosticism with a capital G, but rather Gnosticism with a lowercase g. So we're now going back to a kind of resurgence of the historical phenomenon, the religious group of the original Gnostics, but rather certain Gnostic elements and ideas that percolated through the ages in time and through different groups that were called differently, that had different names throughout the East and West. So you have a spreading of these ideas in different movements with different names, but still possessing that same basic Gnostic structure.
I'm talking with Dr. Natanella Elias, who was educated, got her PhD from Tel Aviv University, and whose book, which she modestly calls a monograph, I read it. I don't think it's a monograph. I think it's a book. It's entitled The Gnostic Paradigm, Forms of Knowing in English Literature of the Late Middle Ages from Macmillan. And let me sort of ask this question from a kind of Orthodox Catholic point of view and so that we really can get our listeners in on what's the issue here. Basically, your book is saying that these heretical ideas, which in the, as you say, between the first and fourth century, were part of a movement known as capital G Gnosticism, these heretical ideas, remained alive and well in spite of the fact that the movement itself either died out or was repressed, whichever way you want to look at it, and that they crop up in certain texts of the late Middle Ages in English, which are traditionally considered and interpreted as Orthodox Christian texts. Am I correct?
Right. Yes.
I mean, you mentioned the great scholar D.M. Robertson.
Yes.
Who is someone I read regarding Canterbury Tales, for example.
Right.
And he was someone who did see a kind of a Christian worldview, kind of C.S. Lewis worldview, expressed through these texts. So what got my attention about your book is that you're arguing, and you argue very persuasively, I might say, that certain of these central texts, some of the earliest basic texts of English in the English language, have these heretical, well, and we're just saying this for the sake of clarity, themes in them. Is that right?
Right, right. Yes.
What kind of themes do you see cropping up? Are these the one you described in terms of the movement itself?
Well, the themes that I termed themes of passing are specific to each tale, to each of the texts that I chose. But they're all pretty much, they're all quite similar to one another. They all have the same elements, very repetitive elements that seem to require, to be required in order to have that moment of passing. Now, in the book, I give it a circular structure because I start with an unsuccessful passing and I end with a successful passing.
Right, and this would be a good moment to tell our listeners what three works of literature you deal with. And as you mentioned them, give us a little overview on what they are and how they're significant in terms of that period of English literature.
Okay, well, the texts I chose are largely recognized for their quite overt and obvious religious nature and themes. But more specifically, they all belong to the dream vision genre, which I think is very important for this Gnostic scheme that is in the background. Because the dream vision itself allows this moment of liminality, this moment of in-between that is a prerequisite, that is a requirement for that moment of passing. And I show that in the book. Now, the texts themselves include three poems from the Pearl Manuscript. Nobody actually knows his name, so they call him the Pearl.
What kind of period or what kind of dating do we have on
they're
that?
All, they're all late 14th century poems.
Okay.
So you have the Pearl Manuscript, and because Pearl is probably his most famous work, they call him usually the Pearl Poet.
Okay.
And in the Pearl Manuscript, I speak about all three manuscripts that appear there, except for the fourth one. Well, there's another one, but nobody's sure that it's actually his.
Right. Or hers.
Or hers, yes.
Right.
Yes. That is always possible. So I speak of Pearl, and the second one is Patience, and finally, Cleanness.
Well, you have the Piers Plowman.
Yes, yes. The second chapter discusses William Langland's Piers Plowman.
And give us a basic description of that.
Yeah, it's supposedly a very controversial text, and it has been discussed in all ways possible, I think, until I brought this possibility.
Literary critical bombshell. Now, what's the dating on Piers Plowman?
Piers Plowman is again 14th century, but it more overtly speaks of specifically of the 1381 Peasants' Revolt.
Yes.
Many of the critics and scholars have spoken of those social aspects of Piers Plowman. And I decided to take the more personal route of viewing this as a kind of soul journey, as a kind of soul drama, in the words of Morton Bloomfield. He calls this a soul drama, which is exactly a self kind of reflection, a going into the self in order to be saved eventually. But as I show in the book, it's still not quite there. So this is why
it's not a failed journey. A failed passion?
It's not exactly failed, but it's not exactly a successful
incomplete
attempt either.
Incomplete.
Yes,
now,
exactly.
Now, what's
incomplete
the
would be. Yeah.
Your piece of literature that illustrates a successful passing is what?
Is Gower's, John Gower's Confessio Amantis.
Which is
the
translated?
The Lover's Confession.
Or you call it here the Bower of Bliss.
Yes, yes. It is a Bower of Bliss because he eventually finds himself.
And what's the dating on that? What do we know about Mr. Gower?
Again, late 14th century, the same period as Chaucer. I actually used to teach a little bit of Chaucer in my classes. I used to compare Chaucer and Gower to Elvis and another famous contemporary.
Who was that?
The point is, Chaucer would be Elvis because
and
everybody.
Who would Gower be?
And Gower would probably be who else is famous from that period, but not so much. So, I'm thinking Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah, okay. Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah, so that would work, right? So he's famous, but not quite.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Sort of a B-lister versus a AAA-lister.
Yeah, exactly.
But even being the Jerry Lee Lewis is pretty good.
Yeah, he was.
Is there proof that Gower was widely read? I mean, it must have been.
Yes, there is. He had acquaintances in high places, noble friends, and it is said that some of his work was written for some of the nobility of the time. So definitely, it was widespread and widely read. Perhaps not as much as Chaucer in that sense, but also possibly because of the fact that reading him was not as exciting or funny as Chaucer is.
And would you agree with that evaluation?
I don't think so. Chaucer, yes, was more entertaining in the sense that he was very funny. But Gower was very deep. And his Confessio is, I think, amazing. I mean, it's a bunch of stories, basically, being retold. And you have 8 books, 7 of which are supposed to be the 7 deadly sins. So instead of a parade of the 7 deadly sins, you have actually 7 books filled with stories based on the 7 deadly sins. So I thought that was very interesting and very exciting. And one book that seemingly is incompatible with the rest of the sins, but as I show it, that's actually the locus of the passing. The moment of passing.
Does Dante figure in at all, or is Dante too much of a contemporary to have made it?
It's contemporary, and the same ideas go into all of these works.
Right.
So I think that's.
But they would not have read Dante, even though Dante was published. They wouldn't have read him by then, would they?
They probably did. I assume they did. Gower and his like.
Now, did either Gower or Langland get in trouble with the church, or did they have any ecclesial issues?
No, No. Surprisingly enough, no. Because writers and poets had the benefit of the doubt, basically. They didn't fall. They basically fell under the radar because they wrote fiction. Right. So they could argue that it's always artistic license. So censorship didn't really work on them in that sense.
Well, you mentioned the approach of Leo Strauss,
yes.
Which is famous
subversion.
For analyzing texts that carry within themselves kind of secrets, masked secret meanings, precisely
yes.
in order to avoid official sanction, correct?
Yes.
Do you think that,
writing. Yep.
When you found these Gnostic themes in Langland and Gower, do you believe that they were there consciously, and do you believe that they were sort of operating sub rosa to espouse these, or do you think there was any intention involved?
I honestly don't know. But from a literary perspective, I would have to say that there was no conscious effort to actually put these ideas in. That would be intentional fallacy in literary terms.
Mm-hmm.
So when I discuss literature, I don't really discuss the intention of the author, but rather what the text seems to show.
Well,
because otherwise you fall into this.
That's very high-minded of you. Yeah. Very high-minded.
Thank you.
And I understand, and I respect that. So, let me ask you this question before we get into the text specifically.
Yes.
You know, I understand in some way this sort of journey you're describing, which is a journey toward a kind of unity with some sort of ultimate and some sort of intuitive connection to that which is beyond. I understand the appeal of that, which in some way goes beyond, as you point out, goes beyond doctrine. It goes beyond the kind of, a constriction of historic institutions of religion.
Mm-hmm.
But what doesn't appeal to me, and maybe it's just because I'm a Texan and American and a Republican
yeah.
or whatever, is this idea that it is only for the chosen few, it's only for an elite, it's not available to every person, and somehow
yeah.
as a Christian, having read the Gospels, it doesn't seem to comport with what I see in the Gospels.
Yeah.
Did you ever think in terms of how this elitism may in fact from a Christian point of view be not, let's not call it heretical, let's just call it heterodox.
Yeah. Well, the point of the matter is that this is why Gnosticism doesn't really exist anymore. And Christianity is quite influential and big.
Well, but didn't Eric Voegelin point out the Gnosticism that was implicit in some of the 20th century political movements that were so destructive?
The Gnosticism with a lowercase g.
Right.
These Gnostic ideas
still remain
to this day. I mean,
right.
the ancient religious movements didn't stick around for long.
Right.
But their ideas definitely did.
Okay.
And you see that specifically in 1945. I speak about this in the book. In 1945, the Gnostic Gospels
right.
were discovered in Egypt, in Nag Hammadi.
Tell our listeners a little more about that, because they may not be familiar with the discovery of these manuscripts and the impact they had on biblical scholarship.
Yes. Well, they're hidden scrolls. They were hidden. Nobody actually knows exactly what happened there. But
where were they found? Do you know where they were exactly found?
The place is called Nag Hammadi, probably in the caves. Very similar in idea to the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Right.
That's the way that they used to.
Were these found in Israel?
The Dead Sea Scrolls, yes.
What about the Nag Hammadi?
The Dead Sea. Those were in Egypt,
okay.
And they traveled the world eventually, and nowadays you can actually access them online.
Yeah, they were translated, and they contained what are known as the Gnostic Gospels.
Exactly.
And you talk at length about, for example, the Gospel, I believe, of Thomas, right?
Yes, yes. That's probably the most notable Gnostic Gospel that was found.
And well-known scholars,
mm-hmm.
like Elaine Pagels, for example, who you quote, have made a career, scholarly career.
That's right.
And I don't mean that as a slight, because she's a brilliant writer and great writer, of talking about the meaning of these Gospels, both in their content and in their being rejected by the Church for inclusion in the Scriptures, right?
Right.
And whether or not, as you put it, they posed a threat to the Church and therefore needed to be suppressed. Now, what was the threat?
Well, I think the threat was going back to ancient times.
By the way, that was too big of a question to ask with just 1 minute left in this portion of the program. And what we'll do when we come back on the other side of this short break is we'll talk about briefly about that question, and then we'll get on to discussion of the Pearl, Piers Plowman, and A Lover's Confession. I'll be right back with Dr. Natanella Elias from Israel in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Join me September 23rd through 25th at the Theology of the Body Congress in Southern California. We'll be joining parish leaders, clergy, religious, international experts, and other enthusiasts for St. John Paul II's teaching on the beauty of human love. Love, mercy, and the gift of the family is the gift to help your family through today's marital and gender confusion. You can learn more by going to tobcongress.com. That's tobcongress.com.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
One of the signs of strong commitment between a husband and a wife is that they have a strong identity as a couple. Having a strong couple identity means there's a me, a you, and an us, like the Trinity. All three identities matter, and all are honored in how we go through life together. Unfortunately, new research by sociologist Dr. Paul Amato argues that couples are fast becoming married singles. Millennial couples are substantially less likely than couples in 1980 to eat together, visit friends together, go out for leisure activities together, or work on projects around the house together. They were less likely to participate in clubs or groups together as well. Home alone becomes alone together. Catholic couples can stand against this tide. Make time for your marriage when you plan your week. Remember that the most important activity is family life. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Why am I here? Where am I going? And how do I get there?
Join Father John Ricardo as he discusses these crucial questions through the lens of Pope St. John Paul II's Theology of the Body. You'll gain a better understanding of how original sin destroyed our ability to love and how Jesus' sacrifice and God's grace restored that ability. This 4-CD set makes an excellent gift for all engaged and married couples. To purchase your copy, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on Theology of the Body under the store tab.
Back with Dr. Natanella Elias, who's speaking to us from Israel, and it's rather late over there, and I really appreciate her staying up to talk to us today on Church and Culture. At the end of the last section, I asked you, what is the sort of practical threat that Gnosticism, and then, of course, the Gnostic Gospels, which, you know, become very visible in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, once they were translated, discovered in 1945, and then translated to English, and then became the subject of works by scholars like Elaine Pagels. What is the actual threat?
Well, I don't think there is an actual threat. I don't think there was an actual threat to begin with, but except for, of course, during the first until the fourth century. But from that moment onwards, once they completely abolished the original ancient Gnostic movement with the capital G, there was really no threat. But they kept popping up in different movements throughout Europe, and what is important to understand about Europe in the Middle Ages is that Europe was kind of one entity. I mean, if something happened in one country, it usually reached other countries as well. So there was a lot of movement in Europe. So these movements moved around. And you have clerical envoys going from one place to another and spreading these ideas. Now, I discuss this in the book and say that actually persecution was more for the sake of persecution because there was really no reason for it. At one point, there were really no more prevalent heresies around, but persecution was there.
And a lot of it was politically motivated.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't want our listeners to. I mean, I want our listeners to understand that I think you're right about that. And of course, in the first place, if someone's heterodox, you don't go, you know, put them on a wheel and torture them over it.
Yeah.
You know, or hang, quarter, and draw them, as was being.
Yeah. Yeah. Though that was quite effective.
Yeah. Right. Really helps. So let's start with the pearl.
Yes.
Pearl manuscripts, and you mm-hmm. and you're saying the key to understanding how all three of these pieces of literature, English literature,
yep.
early, is to understand the genre of the dream vision.
Yes.
That they share. How is that? Now explain that to us.
Well, the dream vision basically sets up the scene. And they form this interesting combination. I mean, if you look at the name itself, the term, a dream vision, it's basically a combination of sleeping dreams and waking visions. Right, so they're supposedly contradictory, but
right.
It works.
It's like it's a dream, but it's reality too.
Exactly. Yeah. So there is a prerequisite for the dreamer to fall asleep. But then he ironically and paradoxically wakes up into this vision, which is during his sleep. So, in other words, the structure of the dream vision actually enables the necessary state of repose that I speak at length about in the book, which ironically may eventually actually lead to a reawakening of the character of the dreamer, in its search for ultimate truth. For that.
By the way, should I be reminded of the opening stanza of Dante's Divine Comedy as you're speaking?
Probably.
Yeah, and somewhere in the middle of my life's journey, I wandered into a dark wood, that kind of.
Yes. It's always a dark wood.
So it's similar. It's similar.
Yes. Most of the poems in this genre are very similar in setting and themes. And then you have kind of this long confession style format in which you have two characters having a dialogue. One of them is trying to teach the other some kind of wisdom, and eventually the dreamer wakes up and hopefully a changed man or, you know,
I think then again of Virgil and Beatrice speaking to Dante the Pilgrim.
Exactly. Exactly that. Yes.
So what happens in the pearl? What is said to the protagonist in the pearl?
Well, who is the pearl is a very good question.
Right.
The situation is of a supposed father figure, that is the dreamer, who is looking for his daughter, who supposedly died, and he wakes up into this dream vision in which he sees the Pearl Maiden. He sees his daughter, and ironically enough, she is the one, this child, this infant, is the one to teach him a lesson, or at least she's trying to.
Now, is this daughter, do we know that this daughter has died or she's just lost?
She possibly died because he sits at her grave, supposedly. Again, everything is supposedly because it's really unsure.
It's a dream.
It's all an allegory.
And the dream allows the poet, the writer, to sort of do anything he wants, right? Because the dream is in charge.
No.
The dream is in charge.
The dreamer is in charge of the dream, and just as much as the dream is in charge of the dreamer. It goes both ways. Because it's not just a dream, it's a vision. And a vision has something of a prophecy in it. It has something prophetic in it. So there is a kernel of wisdom in that dream vision that hopefully the dreamer is supposed to attain. But as I show, the dreamer basically goes back to the state he was in before the dream vision, so he didn't really learn anything.
Why not?
At the end of the poem.
Why not? What held him back?
Probably that he wasn't ready, so I'll speak in Gnostic terms. He was probably not ready at that point in time. At the end of the poem, literally speaking, he just there's this stream separating between the dreamer and the Pearl Maiden. And even though she keeps trying to teach him certain things that are spiritual and tells him to renounce the physical and listen to her words of wisdom, he basically ignores her. And by the end of the poem, he jumps into the river.
So he's sort of stuck with his physicality, with the material world,
exactly.
And so forth. Well, that reminds me of Apostle Paul talking about carnality.
Yes.
I mean, that's close to his idea of the carnal mind and so forth, isn't it?
That's right. Interestingly, for the Gnostics, carnality doesn't matter. What do I mean by doesn't matter? I mean, they did not put emphasis on it, so it doesn't really matter what you do in this world, which is actually very good for them, right?
right. That makes it easy.
Yeah, exactly, right? Your deeds don't matter, right? It's just because it's based on a select few.
It's your intellect. It's your intellect?
It's something that is beyond both. It's beyond faith. It's independent of faith and beyond faith. And it's a kind of knowledge that is supposedly inherent in you.
You talk about that remembering.
Exactly. Memory plays a very important role in this.
So are you remembering the source of your being? Are you remembering?
In a way, yes. Yes. It's a knowledge that is supposedly there, that exists in you, but because of carnality, because of becoming incarnate, becoming human, becoming in the flesh, you somehow forgot it.
Now, Augustine addresses that in his own Confessions.
Yes.
I mean, very clearly, that's the dominant theme of his narrative, of his conversion, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That's remembering.
Augustine himself was part of the Manichaeans.
Yes.
Which
was a branch of Gnosticism, correct?
Exactly.
Now, I just want to point out to our listeners so they'll understand one of the great divides in Christian thought is that in this very century, 14th century, St. Thomas Aquinas was writing his Summa Theologica,
right,
where he specifically rejects the idea of any two things. Of any ability to scrutinize oneself,
mm-hmm.
You cannot have reflexive knowledge of yourself. And two, there's no such thing as innate ideas.
Yeah.
So he specifically rejects this what we call epistemology, this theory of knowledge.
Exactly.
Whereas Augustine is operating really from the epistemology of the Gnostics.
Yes.
That there is a remembering of
mm-hmm.
gnosis,
right,
which is crucial to your salvation, right?
Yes. which is
what's the difference then between Augustine and what we're reading about here?
Well, I think I'll quote something from Giovanni Filorama.
Another great writer on the Gnostics.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I think this is probably the best quote I could find. He says that the Gnostic savior does not come to reconcile humankind with God, but to reunite the Gnostic with himself. He does not come to pardon a sin that the Gnostic cannot have committed, but to rectify a situation of ignorance and deficiency and to reestablish the original plenitude. Basically, the Gnostic savior comes to save himself.
Well, that's definitely not orthodox.
Yes, exactly.
And do you think that this is... okay, so we're seeing this pattern in the pearl.
Yes.
You know, could you argue that the pearl, the inability to achieve passing is a rejection of this heresy?
That this
pearl didn't want to go down that path?
Possibly. I mean,
could
it's
you argue
always
it that way?
Literature.
Yeah.
I guess it's possible to argue about anything.
No, I'm just thinking out loud, not to know. I just, you know, but obviously the idea that salvation consists of being reunited with your true self.
Yes.
Would
it's
be
very individualistic.
Yeah, we call that New Age in a crass sense,
yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And but I mean, I don't in any way want to label it there and not acknowledge its connection with mysticism, with the apophatic,
yes.
The via nativa, you know, all these strands of Christian
right.
spirituality, right?
Exactly.
Okay,
I actually speak of the cloud of unknowing, which
yes.
is very famous.
And you talk about the pseudo Dionysius too.
That's right, and via negativa.
Now, what about Mr. Langland? What happened to him and Pierce Plowsman?
Well, this is supposedly very traditional in the sense that this is the soul's path on the way to salvation, an allegory, and you have these social aspects, political aspects. Scholars have discussed almost everything possible about this. But what I think the true emphasis and focus in the poem is actually not just faith, but the search for certain knowledge, that knowledge that I keep mentioning, that is independent of and surpasses faith, and that is exactly what is Gnostic, searching for that Gnosis, for that insight. And you see the same pattern, you see the same structure, this paradigm that I defined from the beginning, in all of these poems. But again, because it's very confusing and it's very, and when I say it, I mean Pierce Plowman, it's a very confusing, convoluted poem with no definitive ending. This is why I think that it's not exactly either an unsuccessful passing, but it's not exactly a successful passing either.
Now this also This is also set up in the dream vision genre, correct?
That's right.
And by the way, remind all of us what the 1381 Peasants' Revolt was.
Well, you had the peasants basically revolting against the taxes. And it was a very dire situation. These people had no food, had no work. And they decided to go against the reigning entities.
Who was the king at the time? Do you remember?
At the time, I think it was Richard, right? I think it was Richard II.
Okay, that's it. My son would know. He's memorized all that stuff. But,
yes. it was between Edward and Richard. I'm
okay.
pretty sure it was Richard II.
All right. And so this is post-Crusades.
Yes. Yes.
And it's you have a bunch of Crusaders coming back from the Holy Land without any work.
Right. And specifically, a lot of the peasants gathered together and wanted to rise against against the king. And
this wasn't where the Robin Hood myth came, did it? Is it?
No. I think Robin Hood was a little earlier than that.
Okay, because it has a similar feel.
It wasn't a very successful result.
So who does Langland talk to in his dream?
He speaks to Pierce. You have
the plowman.
The dreamer. Yes, Pierce the plowman, exactly. He is kind of like a savior figure,
mm-hmm.
and he is supposed to lead the dreamer towards that truth, that ultimate truth with a capital T. And so he goes into this inward journey on the backdrop of this crisis in an attempt to find answers, because that's what you do in a crisis. You try to look for answers. So eventually, he encounters also the characters. All of them are very allegorical. You have characters like Truth, Holy Church, and so on. Just like the Pearl Maiden and Dame Patience and Dame Cleanness in the Pearl Poet's works. So all these lead the character eventually to that moment of salvation, but it doesn't actually take place. There's this very big mess, for lack of a better description, at the end, and everything just breaks apart, and nothing is conclusive, and I keep speaking about reversals. In a scheme of reversals in all of the poems, specifically unnatural reversals, meaning that nothing is quite as it seems. So something appears to be one thing, right, let's say orthodox,
yeah.
but then immediately afterwards you have the exact opposite of that representing that same character.
Wow.
So it's constantly going back and forth.
I'm talking with Dr. Natanella Elias, who's talking to us from Israel about her book, was published last year by Macmillan, The Gnostic Paradigm, Forms of Knowing in English Literature of the Late Middle Ages. Well, let's talk about this last book by Gower, Lover's Confession, in which we have a successful passing. How do we know that it's successful, Natanella?
I think that by the end, I mean, it should be very clear, because in the end, what happens is the main character, whose name is Aman, which literally means a man, but also means a lover.
Right.
And ironically enough, this is a lover who has no love and was very unsuccessful in love. So he needs the teachings of Venus. To lead him in the direction of learning about himself.
Is there a courtly love dimension of this?
Yes and no, because in courtly love you're supposed to have a beloved that is unattainable.
Unattainable, right?
Yes, I would say that yes. He himself is unattainable.
Right.
But he eventually, at the end of the story, what you have is at the end of the poem, rather, he's on the floor, which is a repetition of the beginning of the poem. He was, it's again the circular structure. And at the end, he seems almost completely defeated. But then he receives a mirror. And that's the interesting thing. Once he looks into the mirror, he looks into himself. He looks and sees the true self. He sees his true self, and then all of a sudden, he gets up to his seat, right? He raises up, and that's it. And he becomes a man, right? So he finally earns his position. He finally earns his salvation. He earns his title.
That really fits the narrative you described earlier about the Gnostic themes.
Yes.
Now, if somebody pushed you and said, this portrait of this man who looks in the mirror and becomes a man, earns his salvation, and said, is there no sign of a supernatural element, no sign of a God outside of the self? What would you say?
It's full of supernatural. Almost everything is is supernatural in the Middle Ages. You have all these forces out there, but the self becomes very important.
They don't necessarily mean what you think they mean.
Exactly. Nothing means what you think it means. Everything may mean something else. Anything may mean something else. I mean, basically, it's don't necessarily believe what you see, and don't take things at face value.
Okay, now, so the face value would be like the D.M. Robertson kind of reading of these texts, right? Kind of
right.
Straight Christian allegory.
Exactly. What it seems to say on the surface.
But what you see here from Gower is something that resonates with not the Gnostic small g theme of being reunited with one's true self as being the event of salvation.
Yes.
Now, did we get from Gower what the knowledge is? Is it just a knowledge of the self, or is it involved other knowledge?
No, we don't get the knowledge itself, and I think that's not really the point of these writers. I mean, nobody actually knows what this knowledge is. It's probably personal to each and every person and different for each and every person. And this actually connects very much to deconstruction, and if we go further in time, to Freud and the unconscious. And the real, and all of those notions. So bringing up something from within yourself, which is actually the most familiar to you, and yet it is the most unfamiliar to you.
You know, it'd be very interesting to follow this chronologically into the next generation and the next generation, like, and get to Shakespeare.
Yes.
Is that what you plan on doing with your future scholarship, or what are you going to do?
Yes, that's my plan for a next book, speaking specifically about the Renaissance and Renaissance literature.
Now, what text would you deal with in your next book?
Well, probably a little bit of Shakespeare.
Wow.
I'm thinking in very general terms because I don't actually have a specific plan currently.
Would you do Marlowe?
Marlowe is the very first thing that came to mind.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Faustus.
Yeah, I would think so.
Faustus, interestingly, is actually a character from Augustine's Confessions. And he says it was one of the Manichaean teachers who he was very impressed with. And his name was Faustus, interestingly enough.
Yes, they had a huge pitched battle.
Yeah,
there's an entire volume of writings where Augustine takes on Faustus.
Yes, yes.
Anyone else other than Shakespeare and Marlowe that you have in mind?
Those are currently the main texts that I have in mind.
Is anybody else as a playwright in their, in their class during that period in English literature?
Probably. I don't know if in their class, but probably around the same level.
Are you going to get into Milton?
Milton is very interesting because he's too obvious, a little bit too obvious to deal with.
Evil be thou my good, says
exactly.
says his Satan.
Exactly. So I think that would be a little bit too obvious for me to deal with.
Never avoid the obvious. Natanella, you've been a delight to have on this episode.
Thank you. It was my
pleasure.
You've
been very brave to come on and just based upon a text message from me and being interested in your book. Again, your book is The Gnostic Paradigm, Forms of Knowing in English Literature of the Late Middle Ages. I think you've really helped all of us to understand much better what this thing is called Gnosticism, that was considered a heresy in the early church, but that it has a kind of residual presence in the civilization that is so deeply marked by Christianity. I appreciate your helping us to understand that.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
We look forward to having you on when your next book comes out.
Thank you.
So don't let it be too long.
I'll try.
And I'll let you know the next time I'm coming your way.
Okay, definitely. Definitely. To meet you.
I'd love that. So Nathanael Elias, thank you for being on Church and Culture. And to those of you who are listening, please stay with us after this short message. We'll have another wonderful guest.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by a gift made from our day sponsor to celebrate the 50th wedding anniversary of George and Barb Palmy. These two newlyweds were married in Pacomac Lake, New Jersey in 1966. Parents to three and grandchildren to nine, God has blessed them with a great family, good health, and much love. If you have a message you want to share, be a day sponsor at 877-288-1077.
Weekdays at noon, it's More to Life.
Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. Each weekday on More to Life, we'll explore the life you were meant to live through the theology of the Bible.
Tune in for great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
Some months ago, Father John Ricardo and Father Ron Brown teamed up for an evening of teaching on spiritual warfare.
I think people are here for lots of different reasons tonight. We're like mailmen. We're in the business of delivering the gospel. And because you're a mailman or a mail person, whatever you are, and you're delivering the mail, every once in a while, dogs come after you to try to prohibit you from delivering the mail. So if you're a smart mailman, you carry a stick. So when the dogs come, you can beat them off and you can deliver the mail. That's what we do. But we're also trying to help people, first of all, maybe tell you better get a stick if you don't have one, and to help maybe find you a stronger one as well.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. This dynamic duo will repeat their tag team approach to teaching on November 30th. Their topic then will be the theology of the body. But on our next program, they teach on spiritual warfare. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet. Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Do you have to say things like, "I mean it," or "now," to get your kids to listen? A recent survey ranked the top seven parental, shall we call them, addenda. "I mean it. Did you hear me? I'm not going to say it again. I said, don't make me come over there." Or first, middle, and last name of the child. What's the problem with adding this stuff on the end of your requests or your directives anyway? It just gives them a little more oomph, doesn't it? A little more weight. Well, the first problem is they don't work. In the beginning, they'll grab some attention, but their power fades with time. Secondly, they convey a false message. Do you only mean it when you say, "I mean it"? If you don't say it, does that mean you don't mean it? And you are just talking to hear myself talk. A third problem, these kind of additions tend to get loud. The more they're used, the louder they get, the more the decibel level goes up. How do you get rid of these addenda? My best advice, go cold turkey. Quit using them. Don't say, "Would you please pick up your coat?" "I said now." Use consequences to replace your addenda. "Would you please pick up your coat?" If you don't, guy, you're going to sit for a little bit. Addenda are like drugs. They lose effect over time. I'm Dr. Ray.
Food for the Journey's Sister Ann Shields on a recent self-discovery of how anyone can subtly help those seeking help from the church.
One of the things I've found out in this era of the new evangelization is how many people are coming into our parishes during Mass and they're curious.